Thank you for tuning in to the Daily Music Break podcast. The Daily Music Break at www.dailymusicbreak.com covers music from across eras and genres. We're all over the map because that's where the good music is. Hello, welcome to the first Daily Music Break podcast. We're starting off with a bang. John Harrington is one of the great guitarists on the scene today. John has toured and recorded for more than a decade with Steely Dan. He is a member of the Dukes of September Rhythm Review, which features Donald Fagen, Boz Scaggs, and Michael McDonald. He leads the New York City-based John Harrington Band. He's played with Bette Midler, the Jim Beard Group, the late Phoebe Snow, Madeline Perot, Bobby Caldwell, Lucy Plansky, Jim McDuff, and others. John, welcome, and thanks for taking time out. It's a real pleasure to speak with you today.
Happy to be here, Carl. Nice to meet you, and glad to be inaugurating your podcast.
Well, actually, you're the reason it started. I got this offer, and it was so great, I figured why not just make a series out of it. So hopefully the subsequent people will live up to it. John, you seem, looking at the people you play with, you seem to have a tremendous flexibility in terms of the style of people and bands and performers with which you play. Is the ability to move between styles a talent in and of itself, separate from the pure guitar skills, or does it all mix in together?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I think most of that comes down to the personality of the player. There are people who are born to do one thing and can't stand the idea of doing anything but that one thing, and they become specialists, sort of. And I was never that type, because though I fell in love with a certain genre of music when I was a kid, as I got older and listened to different types of music, I fell in love with different types of music too. And I always had a pretty good knack at absorbing new styles, although some of them were easier for me to grasp than others. So really, over the years, it just was my love of so many different styles that sort of forced me to be more of a jack of all trades than a master of one, you know. And like I said, I think that's mostly just reflective of my musical personality. Like I said, there are guys who just only want to play jazz or only want to play country or only want to do pop music. And, for a long time I worried that I might be spreading myself too thin, but I found I just couldn't argue with it, because, you know, if I tried to specialize, I would always miss the stuff that I was neglecting. So, you know, after a while, I just accepted that was my fate, and I couldn't really change it. And I think once I accepted that, I started to find opportunities that rewarded that diversity rather than, you know, punished it, you know. Because I think it may take people longer. People who don't specialize may take a little longer to sort of get known and understood, because if you're focusing and you're stuck in one genre only, you'll do all your work in that genre, and you know you'll become known for that particular thing because you never do anything else. Well, that was never something that happened to me. So, but you know, Steely Dan is such a hybrid kind of band, and they're a great example of how. How I got rewarded for that kind of flexibility that you're talking about, because you really couldn't do a Steely Dan job well without a pretty serious understanding of jazz harmony, even though it's not a jazz band. You couldn't do it without understanding blues guitar tone, even though it's not a blues band. You couldn't do it without understanding, you know, pop music, and without having, you know, serious musicianship skills. There's an R&B and funk element to their music sometimes. It's nothing if not a hybrid of many styles. So that's my long-winded, you know, about flexibility that way. So, you know, it's great to feel that it sort of did reward me in the end, because I like the variety of the work, and I certainly, you know, am very grateful, you know, for that long history I've had now with Steely Dan.
In the bio I read, it said that you have jazz and classical training. So it seems, I was going to ask you how that has impacted your career, and it almost seems like you've already answered that question.
I did a lot of classical music study in college. I never became a proficient classical guitar player. I only studied it a little bit, but I studied a lot of music theory and composition in college, and got to know an awful lot of music very well that I hadn't known before. And I even though I don't work in any of those styles, I think that the depth of investigation into those musics were that was a really valuable thing, because I learned how to listen well, and I learned how to understand, and I learned about, you know, the details and nuance and the complexity of some music, and that has really served me, I think, very well. I never feel at a loss for understanding what's going on musically in any of the jobs that I've tackled. I always feel sort of on top of it and confident because I feel like, you know, the training helped me that way.
Mm-hmm. It also said that you played several instruments. Why did you settle on the guitar? Was it because it was the coolest instrument, or were there other reasons for that?
In some ways, it was the coolest instrument. I mean, I had played some piano as a kid, which I'm sure was good training for my musical brain, and I never got very good at it, but I used to bang around on it and figure out songs from records on it, and I also played saxophone as a kid. I think I really fell in love with the pop music that was coming out of England and was all over American FM radio in the late 60s, like 68, and that's when I began to play guitar, and the guitar offered me not only just that access to that pop music, because it was a key instrument in all those bands. But it also was convenient because you could sing and play the guitar at the same time. You can't do that with a saxophone. And the guitar was, well, with the exception of, you know, heavy amplifiers, it was sort of portable compared to piano.
Right.
So, you know, it just, you know, and there was something, I fell in love with the sound of the amplified electric guitar, you know, that was a serious thing, and I think I might have enjoyed that sound, you know, the overdriven blues guitar tones that were on like Cream records and Hendrix records, you know, and Rolling Stones records and the Who records, you know, all that stuff, Zeppelin records. That sound, I think, appealed to me because of its vocal quality. You know, it was like all blues guitar players, they play like they sing, it seems to me. And I think maybe the saxophone, you know, I had been used to playing saxophone. I thought of it as a melody instrument. And you know, there's something that's a little bit similar about an overdriven guitar, you know, not an amplified guitar, especially in like a slightly distorted guitar sound that comes out of most blues guys' amps, you know. That sounds a little like a saxophone to me. There's a breath quality to it. It sounds more like a vocal than a guitar that isn't plugged in. You know, acoustic guitar is a beautiful instrument too, but you don't get that held note, you know, the sustain that you get from an amplifier that's being pushed. And that sounds much more vocal to me. And I think that's what I really fell in love with about the guitar at the time. So it was a pretty easy choice. And actually, I kept playing piano and saxophone for a little while when I first learned guitar, because I enjoyed that. But when I got to college, I met a guy who's a still good buddy of mine, I met him the first day I got there, and we each found out the other played saxophone, so we got our saxophones out, and it was clear right away that the guy had been a seriously disciplined practicer. It was clear right away that I had not. So, you know, I was humbled into choosing an instrument to specialize in at that time, you know, and like the guitar won. I didn't want to compete with him on saxophone because I couldn't. He was playing rings around me. So, And, you know, the guitar, like I said, you could sing with it. I could write with it. It was clearly the favorite of my favorite of those three. So.
Do you have a take out the saxophone anymore?
No, I've sold that. Actually, every once in a while, though, I'll ask to borrow one of the guys in one of the bands I play with just to sort of reminisce. You know, I'll get it out and for a joke, I'll play it for a few minutes, and they all get a kick out of it.
I'm sure you're better on that than they are on guitar.
They remember. I mean, they're surprised that I can remember anything. I guess, and I can't remember much, but I really have fun doing it. So I guess they get a kick out of it.
John, who are some guitar players? You already mentioned some bands, but you know, living or dead, who are some guitar players who you would pay to see?
Oh well, I've often paid to see John McLaughlin play because he's astounding. I've paid to see Jeff Beck play. I always find him, you know, so, you know, he's sort of spontaneous and wild and really fun to watch and hear. I absolutely love George Benson's playing and always have. He's a master, an athlete, and a lyricist. You know, a lyrical player, amazing. Those are a few that come to mind right away.
Mm-hmm. But you studied with people who had played with Wes Montgomery too.
I actually played with a bunch of people who played with Wes Montgomery. I played with his brother Buddy when I first got out to Indianapolis. I lived there for about 3 years, and I played with a great drummer named Ray Appleton, who was working with Buddy at the time, and got to play with Pookie Johnson when he was still alive out there in Indianapolis. Saxophone players on a couple of his West records. There were a handful of players who would, you know, I mean, everybody there remembered and hadn't played with Wes because he was an Indianapolis guy, and
right.
And it was, you know, they were, because of Wes, they were huge guitar fans, you know, jazz guitar fans, and I was, you know, you can't study jazz guitar and ignore Wes Montgomery, and so they welcomed me, and I had a lot of fun out there. It was a great opportunity.
So you play with serious jazz people. I mean, that, you know, you really have your feet in both worlds very, very firmly.
Well,
I mean, it wasn't just a fleeting thing.
I don't really think of myself as a jazz player because I don't get to work doing it all that much. But I certainly spent many, many years trying to learn the style, even though at times it felt like an adopted language, you know, second mm-hmm. language and not a first language. But, you know, I truly love it. It's not something I make my living doing, so like I said, I don't feel so identified as a jazz player. But I remember very fondly a lot of those real jazz gigs, and they were real jazz gigs, and we did a lot of them around Indianapolis at the time.
Mm-hmm. What, John, what as a professional guitarist, what do you, if you see a guitar player who you don't know, what do you look for? What makes you say, boy, this person really has something going on here? What's the key to you?
Well, there's a lot of things, I think. I mean, in some ways it depends on what my assessment of what they're trying to do is. I mean, if a guitar player is, you know, I get some students who seem to want to just study the guitar in general. You know, they're not trying to be a particular stylist or artist in one particular vein. They're just trying to learn everything they can about the guitar. And for in someone like that, I look at we look at lots of general musicianship things, like, you know, how do they touch the instrument? What kind of sound do they get out of it? Can they play in tune? Can they play in time? Do they know the fingerboard well? You know, have they studied how it works and, you know, how it's, you know, laid out and all that? You know, so that's one way to sort of assess, you know, a guitar player. But also, you know, when I'm listening to guitar players, I listen for a kind of freshness and a kind of originality and a kind of connection between a musical like self and the guitar player. You know, I don't like to hear guitar players who seem to be just playing without conviction. And I think conviction comes from really hearing the music in your head before you get it out of the guitar. In other words, play head first and not hands first. Because there's a way to play the guitar where you maybe study some sort of fingering positions some people can play in a kind of quite unmusical, disconnected way from on the instrument. And others play more like I guess you'd call from the heart or something. But what I mean by that is with a real strong starting point, that is starting from the musical idea and not from the their hands on the instrument. So that kind of musician would be able to play any instrument well if they spent the time to learn it, but they'd be making music from inside, not from the instrument first. You know what I mean? I think
it's almost like I'm a baseball fan. It's almost like the pitcher versus the thrower thing. Someone who really has an idea out there, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Tell us a little bit, please, about how the Steely Dan relationship started. Probably a question you get a lot.
Well, I do, but it's a pretty amusing one to me because I was asked to do some recording on their first studio album in 18 years at the time. It was probably 1999, and they were finishing the overdubbing on Two Against Nature, mm-hmm. which came out, I think, in 2000. And
which is a fabulous album.
It is a fabulous album. It sounds beautiful, and it's got some really some fairly complex writing, some very interesting writing, and some gems on there, I think. But I had a friend who I'd been working with quite a bit, who named Ted Baker, who was their piano player and had done all the sessions for the basic tracking sessions for everything on Two Against Nature. And there had been a lot of that. And they asked him to recommend a guitar player. And he had a copy of a record I had done for a Japanese label in 1992 and played it a little bit for them in a studio one day. And ultimately I got a call from Walter, who asked me if I could come in and, play on a track, and I did, and we worked for 3 or 4 hours on one song, did a lot of takes, and I seemed comfortable enough, and they seemed happy with it, and at the end of the session, Walter said goodbye and said, "Are you going to be around this week? We'll have you come back and do some more." And I said, "Yeah, I'm around. I'd love to." So I was pleased, and I went home, and a week went by, no phone call. 2 weeks went by, no phone call. 3 weeks. Well, about 5 weeks later, I finally did get a call from Walter again. And, of course, I had given up any hope that he'd call again. but he did call, and he, in his inimitable way, he said, "Oh, you remember that track that you played on whenever that was?" I say, "Yeah, I remember." And he says, "Oh, well, we're not going to use anything that you played." And I said, "Okay." And then he said, "But we would like you to come back in. We got a bunch of other songs we'd like you to play on." And so I chuckled, and he did too, I think. And I went back in, and it was true. They didn't use anything on that first track I had played. But my work survived and didn't end up on the cutting room floor, so to speak, for 4 other songs on that record. And then in the course of those sessions, they asked me, they told me they were planning on a big touring year, and would I be interested in doing the tour? And of course, I said absolutely.
How many times have you toured with them?
I've lost count. It's the first tour I did was in 2000, and for a while we were averaging a tour every 3 years, but then it seemed to pick up. The pace picked up to every 2 years, and now I think we've even had a couple adjacent years. So it's already too many to count, but it's been a working relationship of mine, a regular one for close to 15 years now, I think, which is fabulous. So 14, I think. Yeah.
So I guess it's past the point. Was there ever a point when, you know, you're playing with one of the very, very, very top bands in rock and roll history, really? Was that something that was in the room with you, or is it just once you start playing, it's just musicians playing music?
I think that kind of fades pretty quickly when you're when you've got a job to do, especially a job that's as hard as that one can be. I mean, I felt really overwhelmed in the very beginning, but not by this sort of idea that, oh my God, this is you know, a historic band, but just by the workload. I mean, we had a lot of songs to learn and not a lot of time to learn them. And, you know, I was trying to, for a while I was trying to give away solos, you know, there were so many I had to sort of work on. And, you know, I was pretty fussy about the standard and because the records are so good, I wanted the live playing to be as good as the records, but I wanted it to be, you know, to reflect me and not be just a copy of what was on the records, but, you know, I wanted to bring something of my own to it. And so it was a lot of work, and it was a lot of work in a hurry. So I remember trying to give away the solo to Bodhisattva, which I found particularly difficult. And, you know, I said, Donald, don't you think this would make a great saxophone solo? And he just kind of chuckled and, like, waved his hand and walked away. Didn't say anything. yeah, it was overwhelming, but it wasn't overwhelming because they're so, you know, historically awesome, that which they are. But you get into the work, and I couldn't afford to be distracted that way. I had too much work to do, and it's always been that way, because, you know, their music. First of all, it holds up incredibly well. We've been playing it for years, and it just doesn't sound... Even the stuff that sounds like it was of its time, maybe, in a certain stylistic way, the way rhythm section players play, maybe, it still is so unusual, and it seems to be so much more... have so much more quality in it than so many of, like, the other music of that time. You know, it really stands out to me, And the fantastic thing about it is that it's always challenging to play it again, you know. And you know, I've never had the opportunity until Steely Dan. I had never had the opportunity to play the same music over again with the same great band, same great music, with all that, like, solo space for a guitar player, you know, again and again, you know, with a quality band, you know. And that's... you know, an opportunity to build on what you've done before, year after year, or night after night, with another expectant crowd, you know, where the stakes are high like that, is really transformative for anybody's playing, I think. And it was my first chance to sort of take advantage of that. And I've really tried to, you know, to challenge myself each year, even though it's the same music. And it's a great thing it's the same music. It's not... because there's still so much room to do some different stuff in it. So that's what's fantastic about it.
So you'll approach on a different tour, you'll approach a particular song, particular solo differently from is it from night to night, or is it from year to year?
Well, it can change. You know, the great thing is that, you know, Donald and Walter never have instructed me about how to approach the gig. They gave me complete free rein. And so it's up to me how I want to do it. And because it's such a hybrid genre, you know, it's not like, it's not a jazz gig and it's not a pop gig. It's something sort of in between. And what that means to me is that I have the freedom in different cases to play something that isn't improvised and that's scripted if I think it works best, or to try to get looser and more spontaneous with it, and just do something that I feel in the moment that's different. And I find that different tunes will sort of develop over a tour and over the years in different ways. You know, some stuff that I'll feel like I need to script something just to get through it, you know, because it's difficult. Eventually, I'll do it enough, and I'll find that I don't have to. Mm-hmm. I don't have to stick to the script anymore, because I'm learning how to you know, how to get looser with it and improvise with it. And so it can evolve over the course of a tour. Other ones that haven't started with any scripting of any ideas at all, which seemed like they were easier to just improvise, would sometimes over a tour, like a certain kind of familiar shape will happen in the soloing on a song. And I'm finding that even without thinking of it, I'm kind of working to sort of, you know, to a certain idea that, you know, that only arrive at after several weeks of improvising on it. You know, so something that starts out sounding more improvised ends up sounding a little more scripted by the end of a tour sometimes, because I'm finding out what works and what I like, you know. But the fact that it's free and I can change that up anytime I want is really what makes it endlessly challenging, because if an approach isn't working, there's no chance to get bored, because if an approach isn't working, I have the freedom to change it. So that's an amazing thing. And, it's also interesting to me to sometimes go back and try to remember what I discovered on a certain song, you know, because sometimes I'll go back and listen to something I did like 8 years ago and say, oh, wow, I forgot that there are opportunities to do that kind of thing on that song. And I'll remember them again and try to build on it that way and get some more range on this particular song. So, you know, if I want to have fun with it, there's unbelievable room to do it. So
in front of 20,000 people.
Yeah. You know, you can, well, that's, it makes it a little daunting sometimes, but that just empowers it in a way. It just gives you more to work with that way. It's a pretty rare opportunity. So I'm very grateful.
Mm-hmm. Now the John Harrington bands, it seems like a labor of love. What it seems like you're an individual who wouldn't need to have their own band. I mean, you seem to be very much in demand. Why do you have your own band, and what do you get out of it?
Well, that's a good question. A few years ago, I just tried to sort of look at my musical life, and I asked myself a question. You know, is there anything else that I want to do, musically? And I asked myself, well, if there is, what would it be? And, I've been so fortunate to play with so many really world-renowned artists, and particularly Steely Dan for this long. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing thing. We're going on tour again this summer. And contrary to a lot of people who are, you know, jobbers, you know, who work for other people, even though there are a handful of bands that I think might be really fun to play with and whose music I really love, I don't have any burning need to do more work with different bands. I realized that. I feel very satisfied with the workload of Steely Dan, and I got plenty of work with other artists as well, and I didn't feel like there was any burning need to have more jobs as a sideman, basically. But I did come to the conclusion that, you know, if I were on my deathbed and I looked back and I said I really felt like it would be possible to regret only one thing, and that would be if I never really gave a shot to, you know, having my own band work. And, so that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And since then I've hired an assistant. We've tried to book more shows. We've gotten a website happening. The pace of recording and writing has picked up, pretty dramatically. And, it is a labor of love. Mm-hmm. It's my most sort of personal creative outlet. It's been really fun to do the playing on the gigs. It's great to have the control and design the songs for me to play on. You know, when you're a sideman, you know, if you don't like, you know, I mean, the first year, I mean, I kind of like playing Bodhisattva now, but in the beginning, I really didn't like playing Bodhisattva. And, like, it was too hard.
You keep coming back to that one.
Strange chord progression to me. It's like, oh, boy, this is going to be rough. You know, what am I going to do on this? And I did try to rise to the occasion, and now I, I'm glad I did because I have fun playing it. But you know, when you have your own band, you never find yourself in a position like that because you only design songs that are vehicles. If you want to design songs that are vehicles for your own playing, you can, and I do. And so, you know, it's to have that kind of control is a unique opportunity and a lot of fun. And there's a lot of room in a trio, you know, and Steely Dan has 13 people on stage. So there's, you know, there's not a lot of space, and you got to really control your contribution, you know. But in a guitar, bass, drums trio, you know, there's plenty of room for guitar, and I can do it. I can fill up the space any way I like, and you know, and it's a place. It's an opportunity for me to sing. It's a vehicle for my writing as well, and so it's a ball. I have a blast doing it, and I'm really glad I decided to give that serious shot and give it more time and book more shows and do more records, do more writing. You know, now I mean. I feel like I wouldn't, I have no regrets musically if I get hit by a bus tomorrow. I would love it to be more lucrative because it's been pretty clear that it's going to be difficult to make it, pay as well as sideman, jobs do. But you know, we've improved that over the years. We've definitely, we've been making more money. We started out passing the hat, and we don't do that anymore. And we've got a much bigger guarantee in all these places that we play. And so far, we're really just working driving distances from our homes in New York. But and I would love it if we could expand the territory that way. But right now, because it's I don't have an awful lot of time to be. Doing my own shows since I'm working with other artists. We're booking it when we have time, and I'm doing my own record work when I can find time for it. And I think we'll just keep doing it that way because it's a nice combination. I'm I'm solvent because I've got the sideman gigs, but I'm satisfied artistically because I take the time to do my own records and my own shows.
Do you have a record coming out with the band?
Well, we have the current new one is called Time on My Hands, but it's been out for I forget when we brought it out. It's probably been a year already, maybe a little more. Right. I'm not sure. But we're done with the basic tracking for a new one, and I'm beginning the overdubbing work soon on that. Although it all has to wait until the touring calms down for me to get some time in. But, we got 12 new tunes, and it's going to be a fun record, I think. We got good basic tracking done in a studio in Brooklyn that I really loved working in. And we recorded to 2-inch tape on 16 tracks, so the sound is fat and analog, and it fits the music for me and my taste as well. So I'm excited about it.
I have a total layman's question kind of to end up on. It's something that really is curious to me. I was listening to a very good podcast that you did. I think the gentleman's name is Andy Ellis.
Right.
And you guys were talking, it was way over my head, it was about how you're putting a record together. And all
well,
these
Andy
bits
is a sophisticated, guitar and gear kind of writer as well. So, he knows the details, and that's different from your vantage point here. But yeah,
very
so,
much.
Yeah. So go ahead.
And by the way, I give new meaning to the term non-musical. I mean, I just, I really give new meaning to it. The what struck me is that rock and roll started and it was a, it was very creative, very, spontaneity was a big deal. That was what rock and roll is about. And now, because how the technology and the times have changed, people record albums. They do a little bit here, a little bit there. They do all the engineering stuff that I don't understand. How do you keep the spontaneity and the creativity and the rock and roll kind of ethos in the music when it's being put together a little bit here, a little bit there, some of it in California, some of it in New York, that sort of thing. Is there a conflict there, or is it just happen?
Well, I think basically, you know, the music is going to be as good as the, you know, the musical mind that's the mastermind that's putting it together, you know, because it's pretty clear that you can have great music that basically is great recorded music that either is on one extreme where, you know, everybody's playing everything you hear at one time live in one place, you know, and you just capture that moment and you don't mess with it. You mix it and you're done.
That's it. Right.
Some people still record that way, but you can have a great recording that way. You can also have a great recording that's put together in a much, much more painterly or sculpture-like way, you know, where you start with a drum track or something and nothing else, and then you add a bass part and you add a guitar part or you add a keyboard part and you write the lyrics later. I mean, there have been many, many records that have been done that way. And you know, I've been a huge Beatles fan since I heard them on the radio in the early, well, the mid '60s, I guess. And they're a perfect example. I mean, you can hear the Beatles playing live on the BBC on one of those records. You can, and basically it sounds like the records from that early time in the Beatles. They sound like basically they recorded themselves live in the studio and they captured the moment. And those are fantastic recordings. They're amazing. On the other hand, Sgt. Pepper's was right. a real sort of experimental, overdubbing kind of creation where they bounced tracks down, they did all sorts of experimenting with gear, and that sounds incredible too. I mean, and it's just a different way of working, but it sounds unbelievably spontaneous and vital, right, and compelling. It just is a different kind of work, and so the studio does offer you an opportunity to do either one of those extremes or anything in between, and people use it that way. I love both styles of doing it, and we have a live DVD out,
right,
band,
right.
And that's, you know, I was a little torn because when we were making Time on My Hands, part of me wanted to sort of have that record reflect what we were doing live as a trio, because I thought there was something vital about it. It felt like that would be kind of a cool thing to capture, but with better sound than we normally get on a live show. But as soon as we did it, we started doing it, I just couldn't resist the opportunity to dress it up a little bit. And, you know, I promised myself I'd try to dress it up. If I didn't like it, if I didn't think it was an improvement, I wouldn't keep it. I would just go back to the basic three of us playing live in the studio and use that. But I did like it. And that's what led me to want to do the DVD, so that if anybody wanted that sort of purely live capturing of you know, us playing those tunes, they'd have that opportunity to check it out. But the record making, where you get into overdubs and you get into arranging and, you know, trying different parts, I mean, it's so much fun for me to do, and there's so much flexibility that way now in the technology. And you know, I just couldn't resist it. It's too much fun to say no to. So, I think you have to be careful when you're doing that kind of record to sort of make sure that you don't, you know, edit it to death and like take all the life out of it. But that's why we record the basic tracks as a trio together. And you know, that I think that's just paying attention. But, you know, again, one of the advantages of working on, at my leisure, you know, on Pro Tools at home, well, my little studio's not home, but my little studio, is that, you know, I can work for a while on something, and then I can put it aside for a couple of weeks, come back and hear it fresh, and decide, yeah, is this compelling? And is this, you know, I even if I'm doing the best I can at the moment, sometimes I'll find later, well, what was I thinking? That's not going to work. Or right. I I'm happily surprised. Oh yeah, that does. It sounds totally fine. I mean, I'm happy with the impact it has, and you know, or the power of the performances. Does it feel compelling, or does it just sit there? Is it boring? You know, does it, you know, so you got to ask yourself those questions, and you try to find as much perspective as you can to make the right choices. But so, you know, there are pitfalls in working that way, and you can sort of, you know, work too hard and like clean it up too much, and then it loses some of its character. You don't want that to happen, so you got to be careful. But I don't get obsessive about it. I'm fussy to a degree, but I also want it to sound natural, so I try not to beat it to death. You know?
Sounds like writing. I mean, it's you know, which is what I do. Sure. You need a good editor.
Yeah, I mean, well, the editing. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, rewrites can make something that started out as a not very powerful idea into something something really amazing. And other times, the rewrites will just sort of dull the sort of, you know, that spontaneous edge of it, you know. And so you just gotta, you gotta have a perspective that on it that allows you to make the best choice. And, you know, some people are better at it than others, and you know, but you know, I think getting away from it and coming back to it repeatedly allows you to, you know, make better choices, and that's what we try to do.
John, I'd like to thank you very, very much for taking time out today. This has been great. I could go on all afternoon chatting and trying to ask decent questions.
Well, I appreciate it, Carl. It's been fun to do, and I wish you luck with the rest of the podcast. I'm glad for the series. Glad to help.
Okay, thank you very much. We've been talking to John Harrington. This is the Daily Music Break podcast. And thank you very much, and we will be back soon with another podcast. Bye-bye.